May not recognize their names, but you'll very likely recognize their songs. Husband and wife team Felice and Boudelot Bryant were in Nashville for a long time. They arrived there in 1951 and became the city's first full-time independent songwriters. And in the process, they created country music that appealed to audiences of pop and rock. Along the way, 6,000 songs and sold 350 million copies. In the conversation to come, we'll find out how they did it. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me from a distance are another married couple, Bobby Malone and Bill C. Malone. Bill is the author of Country Music USA and other books, and Bobby is the author of various books. They've co-authored the book Nashville's Songwriting Sweethearts, the Felice and Boudelot Bryant story, published in 2020 by the University of Oklahoma Press. And Bill, I'll say welcome back to University of the Air to you, and Bobby, welcome to you.
Thank you.
We're glad to be back.
Now, the parallels are inviting between these two married couples, Bill Malone and Bobby Malone, and Felice and Boudelot Bryant. Did that play at all into your interest in this songwriting couple?
Well, indirectly. I mean, we actually found out more about the parallels after we got into working on it. Originally, Bill was part of the convocation of consultants that were called to Walpole, New Hampshire, to Ken Burns' headquarters in the fall of 2018. And one of the other couples that was there, some spouses were there, was Dale Bryant, and he's the son of Boudelot, and one of their two sons. And he was also the former head of BMI. And when Ken was going around introducing people, and he said something about Boudelot and Felice Bryant's son, and boy, my ears just perked up because I knew Felice was from Milwaukee. So the first break, Bill went off to get coffee and talk to somebody, and I made a beeline for Dale, and I said, "Boy, I know your mom's from Milwaukee. I know the Wisconsin Magazine has never done anything on her, and I would love to write an article about her." So I told Bill I'd never ventured into his world of country music.
So she came back and told me about the conversation, and I said, "Well, why stop with Felice? Why don't we just write a book about both of them?"
It would seem inevitable, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we broached the topic to Dale Bryant, and he was
thrilled.
He thought it was good, and we should say that he was very helpful all the way through, gave us all the support we had hoped for.
We don't think a lot about, at least I think most of us who listen to music don't think so much about the songwriter, unless it's a singer-songwriter, and you say, okay, that's, you know, James Taylor or somebody, you recognize their songs because they're the one performing them. But in the case of the Bryants, and I suppose many other songwriters, and you wouldn't necessarily say, oh, that's a Felice and Boudelot Bryant song.
Well, you know, I love the Everly Brothers. They're still my top group ever.
I'm with you there.
And from my childhood, and Bill knew that I loved the Everly Brothers, and he told me about Boudelot and Felice. So when I got the job at the Historical Society, he said, "You know who's from Wisconsin, and Milwaukee is Felice Bryant." So because they wrote all those hits that I adored when I was 14.
Well, I'm reminded of the story of Paul Simon. We had a brief conversation with him. He said when he was just a youngster, and he and Simon Garfunkel were already experimenting with singing and songwriting. And one day, the version of Everly Brothers singing Bye Bye Love came on the radio. And it excited Paul, and he got on a bus. I think he took about three different buses and streetcars around New York.
Subways
to get to this favorite record store. And he bought a copy of Bye Bye Love, took it back home, played it over and over again until he scratched it. So he got back on the bus, same trip across New York, got another copy. And so one thing that struck him about it was he looked at the label and he saw the names Boudlow and Felice Bride, and it intrigued him. And of course, I've heard a similar story from some famous English musicians.
Graham Nash
told a similar story.
When we were doing interviews, and Dale Bryant was really helpful. He'd call us and say, "You know, I've got this interview set up with Paul Simon, or you're going to talk to Sir Timothy Rice." He said, "You know, they were all so crazy about my folks and their my folks' music, and they said that they just stopped dead in their tracks. It's growing up in England, and of course the Everly Brothers made an even bigger impact on the development of music in the British Isles, which they re-exported to the United States as the Beatles and all the rest."
I think you mentioned in Songwriting Sweethearts that the Beatles referred to themselves as the English Everly Brothers. Well, let's go back and trace these two biographies and weave them together of Felice and Boudlow Bryant, starting with Boudlow, who, like a lot of performers back in the 30s and 40s in particular, could kind of play any sort of style. Was he as versatile as he seems to have been in terms of being a musician? He was a fiddler?
Yeah, he was a famous musician before he ever started writing songs. He was from a small town in Georgia, and he received a classical music education. His father was a small-town lawyer, and I guess they may have had a little bit more money than most of their neighbors did. So he hired the services of a music teacher who had come down to Georgia from the East. And so Boudlow learned everything he could, but after he graduated from high school, he went down to Atlanta and stayed with one of his aunts, got a job with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. Of course, they didn't pay very much, and he was ready to play any time he had the opportunity.
And his dad had also encouraged. His dad was very Catholic in his musical taste too. So he would take Boudlow down to the courthouse, and they'd listen to old guys playing fiddle tunes, and he put Boudlow into fiddle contests growing up. So
Boudlow had grown up hearing all kinds of music and being receptive to it, everything from country fiddling to some funny music. Anyway, one day he was in a music store in Atlanta, and this country musician came in just to look over the instruments, and he found that Boudlow was a fiddler, and he asked him to demonstrate a little bit of what he could do, and he hired Boudlow on the spot. So Boudlow began playing for country bands, and he eventually got a job with a well-known Western swing musician named Hank Penny. They played all over Georgia and up into the Carolinas, I guess down into Florida. And so by the time Boudlow arrived in Nashville several years later, his name was already known among country musicians. And so that gave him an entree into Nashville.
At least it gave him the entree into the backstage at the Grand Ole Opry, where Chet Atkins especially had championed his...
Chet Atkins knew about Boudelot from the Hank Penny recordings, Hank Penny broadcast. And so when Boudelot arrived in Nashville, Chet kind of took him under his wing, introduced him to all the folks down at the Opry, took him backstage, and that's how Boudelot started writing songs. He's already writing songs before this time, but had very little success with them. But he began collaring all these musicians backstage. Said, "Boy, do I have a song for you. It just fits your style." And so he and Felice started inviting these musicians out to their trailer home out on the suburbs of Nashville. Felice would cook us spaghetti and other Italian dishes. This was the time when that sort of cuisine was pretty exotic in Nashville. So she would cook up the dish, and while she was doing that, Boudelot would be in another part of the trailer demonstrating a song to musicians. So it was that combination of spaghetti and music.
Probably also lubricated by wine.
It's helped many a songwriter to a point, I'm sure. Now, is it true that they met when he was playing in Milwaukee and Felice was an elevator operator?
Yeah, she was just that, you know, she was about 19, 20. And yeah, she was 20. And she was, she was a very romantic, her name was Matilda Scaduto, and she was from a Sicilian, her parents were Sicilian in background, and they were, she had a rough upbringing, parents that were divorced, and that they weren't cultured, refined people, and she was always escaping into either movies or poetry, and she had had a dream when she was, I think before she was a teenager even, of meeting this tall, dark man with a beard, and he was going to be the love of her life. And when she saw...
He would sweep her away from all that.
When she saw Boudelot, where she was standing at the foot of the elevator, she thought he was walking toward her to get a drink from the water fountain. And she said, "Can I buy you a drink?" And she turned on the water fountain and soaked his tuxedo. And it was that was it. He was, a few hours later, he was introducing her to the other members of his quartet as or trio. He was telling them, "This is my fiance." So 5 days later, they ran away together. So it had to have been... It was pretty fast and furious. As Dale said, my parents married in a passion, and I grew up in a passion. And the passion was for each other and for the music.
But the music itself, I gather, for a lot of songwriters, especially starting out, is really kind of a grind, isn't it? It's a great way to live in poverty.
Yeah, they were really struggling and living in their little trailer when he was playing. And Boudelot had an alcohol problem from, he couldn't pick up the fiddle without picking up a drink. And so...
He always had these problems of anxiety before he played. And so one of these doctors that he consulted said, "Well, Boudelot, why don't you just take a little nip before you go on the stage? That'll settle your nerves." So Boudelot started doing that. Started taking one, of course, led to another. Before long, he had a drinking problem. And one of the, of course, credits to Felice is not only did she make him a good wife and musical partner, but she also helped him with his alcoholic problem. And of course, he never overcame it completely, but he was able to work with it and work very successfully at it, I might add.
Well, they start writing songs. Is he still performing, still kind of working the circuit?
Oh, yeah. And she, and in fact, they even performed together. They began writing songs when he was, moved back to Georgia, and he was playing with a local band, country band there, and he'd come home late at night, and Felice was bored, and she'd be writing poetry because, you know, she always loved poetry. And after he'd come home from a gig in the middle of the night, they'd start working on it just to entertain themselves. There was nothing to do.
They say, what did the little lady do today?
That wouldn't play too well today, would it?
And then
she'd pull out her poems.
She'd pull out her poems, and they'd start writing music to them. And when they got about 80 of them, they decided, she said, we should do something with these. We can do something with these.
And so Goodloe began contacting all the musicians he knew and, you know, put some ads in Billboard magazine and got nowhere with any of them. And during these days when he was writing songs and they were performing together, they actually performed over WBAY in Green Bay, Wisconsin. They had a pretty successful little act there. But the weather got too cold. They were afraid their little trailer couldn't handle the northern weather, so they left Green Bay and headed back home, and they went through Nashville. And they contacted a fellow named Fred Rose, who was a very successful songwriter, but also one of the big guns in Nashville. Along with Roy Acuff, he had organized the most successful publishing house in Nashville. And this is just when Nashville was beginning to advance toward being the Music City USA. And so they knew about Fred Rose, and he knew about them.
And they already had one hit. They already had Country Boy, which they'd done for Little Jimmy Dickens.
And they'd been singing that in Green Bay.
And we're going to find out actually how that sounds when we return in a moment. The first big hit for Felice and Budlow Bryant. This is University of the Air.
But there's one thing sure as shooting. I hate those folks who think that they're so dad-burned highfalutin. I'd be the same in Hollywood or right in my own kitchen. I believe in fussing when you're mad and scratching when you're itching. I'm a plain old country boy, a cornbread-loving country boy. I raise Cain on Saturday, but I go to church on Sunday. I'm a plain old country boy, a cornbread-loving country boy. I'll be looking over that old gray mule when the sun comes up on Monday.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guests. They are Bill and Bobby Malone, and they're giving us the story of Nashville's Singing Sweethearts, the Budlow and Felice Bryant story. And we mentioned just a second ago the song Country Boy and a performer named Little Jimmy Dickens, and I gather Little Jimmy Dickens actually matched his nickname.
Little Jimmy was from West Virginia. He was a very popular singer on the Grand Ole Opry for several decades. He was about 4'10" tall, but he had a big voice and a big personality, and that contributed to his success. And he had a few hits before Country Boy, but he had had a song called Take an Old Cold Tater and Wait, and so his managers felt that a song like Country Boy would fit into that that persona. Country music is pretty strong. It's following up one song with another one. They're similar to it, you know, sometimes to a great detriment. But
in this case, it was perfect because Felice and Bugalo had written that song, and this was the first song that they had recorded successfully.
This was in 1948?
Right.
Yeah.
So she had become, she went from Matilda Scaduto to Felice Bryant very quickly because Bugalo didn't think she looked like a Matilda. And renamed, when she met Bugalo and met the man of her dreams, he gave her a new identity, literally and figuratively. He said, "You look more like a Felice, somebody that's happy and smiley." And of course, it sounds great with Bugalo too. And he said, "And I don't much like care for Scaduto either." And she said, "Well, what would you have that be?" And he told her Bryant. So she gave up her name completely, as well as the identity she hadn't developed, you know, and got to be Felice Bryant. And here they had, you know, a big singer making a hit out of their very first song. So that was the entree, really, to Nashville.
1950.
And what kind of place is Nashville? It is musically has changed over the years, but what was going on in Nashville in 1950?
Nashville was beginning to grow. It had been just a small southern town, but musicians were pouring in from all over the country. Publishing houses were beginning to appear there. It was right on the edge of recording, too. And so it was really building a musical identity.
Much to the dismay of some of the city fathers and who wanted Nashville to be, because it was also a university center with Vanderbilt and even Fisk.
And a replica of the Parthenon.
and Andrew Jackson's
Hermitage.
They, you know, were trying to be the Athens of the South, and these hillbillies were were bringing money into the community, but they were also giving it a very different reputation from the one that the city fathers had in mind. So it was mixed in its reception to all these hillbillies.
So Felice and Bugalo Bryant, are they writing now at this point to sell songs to specific performers? Are they writing in the kind of the general prevailing style of Nashville in 1950-51, or are they striking out on their own?
Well, they're tailoring their songs to the style of the individual performer, and they were very good at that. You know, they had a song they thought might fit Ernest Tubb. They would approach him and talk him into listening to the song, or if it fit Carl Smith or Eddie Arnold. And of course, Eddie Arnold was a big hit maker for them. Well, just about the first song, I guess, that he did for the Bryants was "How's the World Treating You?" That's a song that Bugalo had written with Ted Atkins.
And who recorded that then first?
It was first recorded by, I think, a couple of sisters whose names I can't recall right now.
Was that the Beaver Valley Sweethearts?
Beaver Valley Sweethearts.
But that's why Bill couldn't remember it.
But it seemed to fit Eddie's style. He did it and was successful with it. Of course, later on, he did other songs that they had written.
I guess a lot of performers covered that one, and it is a very versatile tune. I mean, Elvis recorded it in 1956, and much more later, of course, we have this version with James Taylor and Alison Krauss.
I think that's one of the best versions of all.
And Marty Robbins of El Paso fame also, I think, recorded "How's the World Treating You?"
The Louvin Brothers and just Jimmy Dickens, on and on. There's many recordings of it.
And though Felice's name didn't appear on it, because I think Chet never wanted her name on it if he'd worked on something with Bugalo, and she had trouble becoming, country music remained and still remains male, like most American music styles, male-dominated. She worked on every song with Bugalo. So she didn't always get the credit she deserved. But she fought for it nonetheless.
How are these songs written by the Bryants? In other words, some songwriters, I guess, it's a lyricist and a musician, and some it's a kind of a blend. How did the Bryants work?
Boudlow shaped up the songs. I think many times Felice had the idea for the song, or she would come up with a melody, and then they just started trading it around, experimenting with words. But
sometimes they would trade that role back and forth. I mean, sometimes it was, you know, he'd come up with a melodic phrase or just some wording, and then they both contribute to it. They mixed on that, but he was the musician, and he was the polisher of the music.
Has he stopped playing, performing at this point?
He had stopped performing. He had stopped performing. He could not perform without drinking, and that was an issue. And this songwriting worked out because they were able to, as you talked about, to write at home in their trailer, to sell the songs that way, and he did not need an office to do that. So they were, and he was able to be, they were both able to be home with their boys. So they, it became Team Bryant. The boys, as they grew up right with the music, hearing their parents, hearing their parents work on songs, hearing their parents sell the songs, and they both became part of the music business.
Felice does have credit for, solo credit, I guess, pretty much, for one of their major hits, which
yes.
You mentioned.
We Could was solely her song. It was his birthday, and she saw him asleep in his favorite chair. And she thought it was just a real sweet picture, and she was just sort of inspired to write the song.
Inspired to write the song and didn't have money for a birthday present. And she said it was the only thing that she ever wrote that he never touched. That was hers because he wouldn't touch it because he thought it was perfect just the way it was, and it was for him. So, she was proud of that. And yes, it was recorded and re-recorded and re-recorded. So, yes, I think it is a beautiful song.
And you mentioned the Leuven Brothers, and they're one of the performing units that did record We Could.
If anyone could find the joy that true love brings a girl and boy, we could, you and I. If anyone could ever say that their true love was here to stay, we could, you and I. When you're in my arms, I know you're happy to be there. Just as long as I'm with you, I'm happy anywhere. Praise night and thank the Lord that all is right. We could, you and I.
Did Felice and Boudlow perform We Could, or did they record it?
No,
they didn't.
She recorded a few songs. They did lots of demos, but Felice never really tried very hard to be a successful singer. I think she had her own version of stage fright. She was more interested in writing songs and arranging them. In fact, if she had been able to carry out her lifelong dream, it would have been as a Broadway composer. That's the kind of music that really appealed to her. In fact, they once had a chance to live a part of that life. The famous composer Frank Lesser, you know, the composer of Guys and Dolls and
yes.
other very successful Broadway productions. He came to Nashville solely for the purpose of talking to them and persuading them to come back to New York and being part of his musical empire. But Fred Rose talked them out of it. Of course, I think they were very reluctant to go in the first place, but Fred Rose said, you don't want to go to New York. Boudla will never be able to handle that pressure.
Well, Fred was a
reformed drunkard himself.
and he understood what that would mean. Plus, their family meant more to them. They'd already become established in Nashville.
They didn't want to raise up little boys in New York City.
Yeah,
that would be culture shock.
I think they were too comfortable and were making a name for themselves, and they'd found a niche, and they had it all to themselves until other people started following their lead.
Which one thing they got from Frank Lesser was this idea that they should control their compositions.
Their copyright.
Their copyrights.
That's important.
So they worked out a deal with Wesley Rose, who took over Acuff Rose House. And that meant that after 10 years, full rights to their songs, you know, reverted back to the Bryants. That was the first time any composer, certainly in Nashville, had ever had that kind of arrangement.
We're going to look at what's probably the best known and was perhaps the most gratifying relationship between the Boudlows and performers. That would be the Everly Brothers right after this. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air, and my guests are the authors of Nashville's Songwriting Sweethearts, Bobby Malone and Bill C. Malone. And we follow the career of Felice and Boudlow Bryant from the late 40s into now the 1950s in Nashville, and probably the group that I've mentioned that is best known in terms of their songwriting, their cooperation with Boudlow and Felice Bryant would be the Everly Brothers. How did the Everly Brothers' relationship with the Bryants begin?
Well, the first time Boudlow ever heard about them was when he was in a barber's chair somewhere there in Nashville or right outside Nashville. The barber happened to be Ike Everly, a musician himself and the father of Don and Phil Everly. And I guess everybody who came into the shop got the same story. You know, he'd tell them about his, boy, you ought to hear my boys sing. They are really good. Of course, Boudlow didn't pay much attention to it at the time because he was always hearing about somebody's kids, you know, who were very good. So he knew about them but had never struck up a business or musical relationship with them.
But Chet Atkins had.
Chet Atkins knew their work and was, you know, trying to get them associated with some sort of publishing house.
And meanwhile, Boudlow had written what he knew would be a great big hit. He and Felice had written Bye Bye Love. He was sure it was a hit before they really started developing the song.
By this time, they were building a big house out on Old Hickory Lake. So one day they were driving out to the lake with the boys, and it was raining a little bit, and the windshield wipers were going. And he said, boy, you got to hear this song. This is going to be a big hit. And I think I know who will record it. It was a Nashville duo named Johnny and Jack. And, of course, Felice had not heard it at this time.
And she said, it's a hit if you say so, Boudlow. You know, she wasn't I mean, it wasn't anything too much to it yet, but as they were, as they spent the day together and worked on it together, it became a good song, but they had trouble convincing, well, they couldn't convince Johnny and Jack to do it. And then they couldn't convince several other people they approached.
Supposedly about 30 other acts heard the song and rejected it.
But and the Everlys said they would have recorded anything. And and here was Bye Bye Love.
They were in town for a recording session with Cadence Records. Archie Blyer, the band leader, was in Nashville looking for talent. And so Boudlow went to the recording session and brought some songs he thought that ought to be recorded. And one act that appeared for an audition was Don and Phil Everly. So they tried out Bye Bye Love. First take or two, didn't do much with it. So during one of the intermissions, Don was just sort of fooling around with the guitar, playing some riffs, particularly one riff that he had learned from
Bo Diddley.
And Boudlow heard it. He said, "Don, why don't you put that up at the front of the song and see what we can do with it?" And he did. And a lot of people think, "Cool." So that's what made Bye Bye Love so successful. It was that Bo Diddley riff that introduced the song.
And just the energy and of course the harmony that the Everlys put into that song.
They were all about those harmonies for sure.
They were all about those harmonies. And right after that hit, then Boudlow and Felice wrote songs specifically.
Yeah, they had
for
written
the Everlys.
They had written "Bye Bye Love" for anybody that was recorded. But after it hit big, then they began writing directly for the Everly Brothers. I think they wrote something like 30 songs altogether. And that included songs, "All I Have to Do Is Dream," and "Wake Up Little Susie," and "Take a Message to Mary," and on and on.
Dream.
You know, they wrote more than that for the Everlys. That's how many the Everlys actually recorded.
And including, obviously, some of their biggest hits. I can't resist a quick little sidebar for Take a Message to Mary. There's a funny story about the kind of the little clattering sound at the beginning of that song.
Right. Well, Felice said that she had started that song while Boudlow was out of the house. She was doing the vacuuming, and a pebble had gotten caught into the vacuum cleaner, and it was kept making this little noise every time it would go around, and the rhythm gave her the idea for the song. And the only thing Boudlow did is he wrote the little what would you call it? The little intro part. This is the
tale of a frontier lad
who lost his love when he went bad.
Went bad, yeah. And then the rest of it was her song. And she said when they went to the recording studio, I don't remember who was that engineer. He said it didn't sound right. Take this. He told Boudlow to take a Coke bottle and hit the Coke bottle to give it a little more rhythm. And Felice said he didn't know about the rock and the vacuum cleaner, but it gave it the exact same sound.
Or tell her that my ship set sail. You can say she better not wait for me, but don't tell her I'm in jail. Oh, don't tell her I'm in jail. Take a message to Mary, but don't tell her what I've done. Please don't mention the stage.
There were some other great stories about and behind some of these songs that they wrote for the Everly Brothers. Of course, is "All I Have to Do Is Dream," which is a fairly simple song, but it was one of their biggest hits from 1958, I guess. Was that autobiographical?
I don't know. They wrote songs constantly, always come up with ideas, and I don't think that all of them necessarily had a specific history to it, nor any kind of biographical link.
I think the most interesting
thing about... But I guess it could have been associated with that dream she'd had.
And I think that they wrote more, you know, Bill always jokes that country music, you know, when Bill and I would be performing, he'd say, you know, we're going to do... you tell it,
well,
Bill.
I'd say that there are not many happy songs in country music, and we're going to do both of them tonight.
But actually, Bulo and Solis wrote several happy country songs, and that had to do with their own relationship.
Wake Up Little Susie. I don't know what inspired that, but Bulo was just strumming on his guitar downstairs out at their old Hickory home. And Felice was upstairs, I guess, doing some work.
Well,
and
still asleep.
Still asleep. And she heard the song coming, what was the little bit that he'd done of it, coming up the stairs. She said, boy, that sounds good. I want to be a part of that. So she came down. And she first heard it, she thought it was a little bit too risque. So she changed
it. This was the 50s, you know.
She put in the part about them being in a...
In the movie theater.
In a movie.
Oh, okay.
In a car or in a motel or someplace else.
That would not play.
So she sanitized it. And it was an even bigger hit than Bye Bye Love.
Love Hurts was another of their big hits, and again, a simple set of chords, but they just kind of hit the magic of what those chords were, and that was covered by a lot of different acts also, I guess.
By this time, they were working with Fred Foster, who became one of the most successful music publishers in Nashville. In fact, Bulo had built a building outside of Nashville, and he let Fred Foster have one of the floors for his publishing house, and Bulo took the downstairs, you know, for his own business. But anyway, one of the people that was working with Fred Foster was a young man named Chris Christopherson. And of course, there's a story that we may not have time to tell, but about how me and Bobby McGee came into existence. But another performer was Roy Iverson, and Love Hurts was first given to Roy, and Roy did make a recording of it. It was the B-side of his record, and of course it proved to be the big seller. And then after that, it was picked up by all kinds of people. The Everly Brothers did a version of it, and I guess in modern days, the most successful, widely distributed version is that of Graham Parsons and Emmylou Harris.
Love hurts, love scars, love wounds, and marks any heart not tough nor strong enough to take a lot of pain, take a lot of pain. Love is like a cloud
and Nazareth.
Overseas, there was a group named Nazareth who had a huge hit in Europe, probably dwarfed all the hits in this country.
Well, I think it's a credit to the Bryants that such diverse interpretations could be put on their songs and all of them work so well that way.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that Budla would stress when he was very articulate, and I know they gave a talk at the 92nd Street Y in New York City, and it was all about, you know, what is music, and he and Felice had prepared something where they tried to do, they just demonstrated one song in many different styles. And they said, this is what makes a good song. You know, when you can do it many, many ways, and it'll fit any style. And that's what they were going for, because it's more than just writing for one person. It's the longevity of that song that brings in the cash. And they were in business. They were creative people, but they were, as Dale said about his parents, he said, my parents were in the music business, and they were geniuses at both of those, music and business.
I've had nothing but sorrow since you said we were through. There's no hope for tomorrow. How's the world treating you? Every sweet thing that mattered has been broken in two. Dreams have been shattered. How's the world treating you? Got no plans for next Sunday. Got no plans for today. Every day is Blue Monday. Every day. Have parted, to your memory I'm true. Guess I'll stay broken hearted. How's the world treating you?
Well, let's round it out with another of their songs that has certainly made the rounds, and that would be, I think, from 1957, Rocky Top.
Yeah, they were successful enough to build a home up in the Smoky Mountains, up in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. They went up there every summer and every chance they got. But another Nashville personality named Archie Campbell also spent a lot of time up there performing for retired people, of course, for tourists who came into the area. And one day, Archie asked the Bryants, he said, I'd like to do an album of songs about old people, about their problems and their desires. And I wish you folks would write some songs for me that I could use. So they went to Gatlinburg, and they holed themselves up in a little room. Was it Gatlinburg Inn? Is that what you call it?
Yeah.
And, of course, today there's a plaque on the wall of that room. Indicating what happened there. And they were writing songs about elderly people, and Felice got sick and tired of it. She said, I'm tired of writing these songs about old people that are just have given up, and the old dog's dead, and there's no reason for living, that sort of thing. Of course, the songs were really not that downbeat, but anyway, that was her take on it.
She was bored. She was bored, and she said, let's do something else. And he said, let's finish the assignment. And she said, no, I need a break. And so he just kind of got frustrated.
Started banging on his guitar. Wish I was on old Rocky Top down in the Tennessee hills.
Wish that I was. Tennessee hills. Ain't no smoggy smoke on Rocky Top, ain't no telephone bills. Once I had a girl on Rocky Top, half bear, the other half cat. Wild as a mink, but sweet as soda pop, I still dream about that. Rocky Top, you'll always be home sweet home to me. Good old Rocky Top, Rocky Top, Tennessee. Rocky Top, Tennessee.
And they said they wrote it in 10 minutes. Well, they probably refined
it. Probably took a little longer than that.
But they had the basic ideas down fast. And it's one of the state songs of Tennessee, and the Tennessee... it's their
University of Tennessee
fight
song.
It's their fight song. Yeah, it's the On Wisconsin, you know, of,
and,
of Tennessee. And every bluegrass band in America knows it. It played it.
It is to bluegrass what
the same when the
same things go marching in is to jazz. Saints.
And first recorded by the Osborne Brothers, I guess.
Yeah,
released.
A popular bluegrass band, and it became their biggest hit and one of the most popular bluegrass songs in the world, I presume.
And was released Christmas Day of 1967. Bill and Bobby Malone, it has been a pleasure talking with you and sharing some music with you. They are co-authors of Nashville's Songwriting Sweethearts, the Boudreaux and Felice Bryant story, published in 2020 by University of Oklahoma Press. And look forward to our next conversation with Bill and Bobby Malone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.
Wild as a mink, but sweet as soda pop, I still dream about that. Rocky Top, you'll always be home sweet home to me. Good old Rocky Top, Rocky Top, Tennessee. Rocky Top, Tennessee. Once two strangers climbed old Rocky Top looking for a moonshine still. Strangers ain't come down from Rocky Top, reckon they never will. The corn won't grow. Dirt's too rocky by far. That's why all the folks on Rocky Top get their corn from a jar. Rocky Top, you'll always be home sweet home to me. Good old Rocky Top, Rocky Top, Tennessee. Rocky Top, Tennessee. Rocky Top, you'll always be home sweet home to me. Good old Rocky Top, Rocky Top, Tennessee. Rocky Top, Tennessee. Rocky Top, Tennessee.